Hey, I'm Andy White, and welcome to Masters of Medic. This is the show where we talk to the best of the best in enterprise sales. In this, episode 2, we're talking to Cliff Dorsey, the Chief Revenue Officer at Welcome Software. Cliff has been leading sales teams for over 23 years and has a ton of wisdom that I think you'll really enjoy hearing. And if you do, then please do not forget to subscribe and to leave us a rating. Hey, Cliff, thank you so much for joining me on Masters of Medic. It is an absolute pleasure to have you on the show. Looking at your resume, your experience, it's mind-blowing. Like, you know, for someone like myself earlier in my career, when I look at, you know, your career, it's kind of one of those things I sort of aspire to. So to have you on the show, yeah, and to get to talk to you is brilliant. Perhaps for the people listening and watching, if you could introduce yourself, tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got into this wonderful world.
Happy to do it, and thanks for having me. So I'm currently a chief revenue officer at NewsGrid, now has been renamed to Welcome Software. Have been in sales and sales leadership for 20 some years. I am a mechanical engineer by education, army officer by first profession, which I think we can get into a little bit. Is it certainly set a foundation for kind of training and development and discipline, which has kind of been part of, I think, my playbook and the success we brought to like building growth oriented teams. I was very fortunate to be hired early in my career. Actually, my very first technology selling job, I think it was 3 years out of the Army, by Parametric Technology Corporation. So back in the late 90s, this was a very, very transformative period for me, where, you know, the things that I learned, the discipline as both a seller and a sales leader, did a few different stints with PTC, all told about 4 years with that organization. And from there, stayed in sales leadership. Places like LivePerson, Medallia, and now with Welcome. So I'm very happy to be here. You know, Medic is certainly something that is one of the fundamental components of kind of what I bring to our sales team and what they execute. So really excited to get into this topic.
Thank you. The bit about the U.S. Army and being a captain in the U.S. Army is fascinating to me. I've seen, certainly in the U.K., I know of a number of people in sales that have come through, in particular the Army, actually the British Army, who have gone on to just have tremendous sales careers, where I've seen other sales leaders almost try and replicate. They're like, right, well, we need to just go and like find people that are leaving the military and hire them because they make great salespeople. What is it, do you think first off, do you agree? And secondly, if you do, why?
Yeah. So it's interesting you say that because, you know, at the time with PTC, selling engineering and CAD software, that, you know, athletes, military, and then because I was a mechanical engineer, I was somewhat the ideal profile for what they were looking for at the time. You know, I think that, the combination of being given so much responsibility at a young age, you know, as a 22-year-old person responsible for the lives of 40 people and, you know, tens of millions of dollars worth of equipment, that's unusual, right? So it matures you pretty quickly as a leader. And then there's not too many organizations where, you know, I was in at a time of peace. So if you're not at war in the Army, you're training. So you become an expert in how to train and how to develop and how to build performing teams. And I think those methodologies, the processes adapt and lend themselves well to sales training, which has a lot of parallels.
Right. There's one of the things that's sort of famous around the PTC sales team is kind of the level of sort of I don't know what the word for it is, but sort of enthusiasm would be a nice way of putting it. Some people would say aggression in the sales team. How did you find it coming from, you know, a very structured, disciplined organization, which would, I'd imagine the U.S. Army is, into a kind of, you know, a sales organization full of sort of red-blooded, steak-eating salespeople?
Very true. However, like I found a lot of similarities, right? Oh. it was hard. Like the standards were very, very high. The expectations were very, very high. And if you didn't meet them, you weren't going to last very long. Right. So, I remember very clearly in my first sales leader role, you know, the expectation is if you had it, because it was very easy to get sent home from training. So you would literally go to training and you might get sent home the first day. The person who got sent home got in some trouble, but it was the sales leader that was at big risk.
I see.
Right. So the level of accountability I found, while scary, was very important to the success of that organization.
Right. One of the things I've heard from other PTC leaders is that when you join PTC as you did, as often was the case with their hiring approach, was your first sales role. And I've heard PTC salespeople say they didn't realize how lucky they were to land at PTC as their first role, because since then they've never learned as much again since.
True. It's very true. I had no idea. So I was in medical sales at the time, so nothing related to technology. The sales leader, that's the other thing is, as a sales leader, your job is to get the best, one of the most important jobs is to get the very best people and talent on the team. So I'll never forget the day that Mark Teagarden from PTC cold called me and tracked me down and told me about the opportunity with PTC. And it's very fortunate that I listened.
Oh, I love that. And obviously, I'm looking at your resume. I can see, you've kind of followed the path of working at other companies that are almost famous for using Medic or MedPick. Which is it that you use?
I prefer just plain Medic. It's uh-huh. not that the decision process, or excuse me, the paper process is not important. I just find it perfectly satisfactory to have it live within decision process. And I think it goosed up the aesthetics. So I leave it that way.
Okay. Then that makes sense. And when you went to, when you were joining new organizations, like let's take LivePerson, for example, looking at your resume, you went there quite early on, particularly in relative to the size of the organization when you left.
Yep.
When you went there, did they have Medic? Did you bring it on? What was the situation?
Yeah, I would say, interestingly, it's more ubiquitous now among technology organizations than it was then. But as you might imagine, not only was I there, but there was an ecosystem of people actually that had also been at PTC. Right. So that was something that we pretty quickly collaborated on and implemented as a standard for the organization. Wasn't a very hard sell.
Interesting. And do you find, because I personally implemented Medic a couple of times to sales organizations that haven't used it, and it's been, I almost sort of see different stages, and I'd love to hear your if you found the same sort of thing where it's like, I've not met a salesperson yet that I've talked to who doesn't know Medic, who I've explained the concept to, who hasn't been like, yeah, that's good. No one has ever put up a disagreement or argument against it. And so people generally are open-minded to take it on board and think, yep, I can see the, because it's very logical. But then I almost sort of see different steps of adoption, and that depends very much on the culture of the sales organization and to a degree, the experience of the sellers themselves as well. Do you find that there's a best practice of how you should implement Medic? And what are some of the key learnings you'd say around that?
Yeah. So a few things come to mind. First of which is in the organizations where it's a methodology. I really have three fundamental pillars of kind of non-negotiables in a sales organization. One of them is best practices and discipline around pipeline generation, PG. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. One of them is value-based selling, primarily through things like command of message. But the third principle and non-negotiable is Medic. So I think, when I meet with a new seller in the very first week, like that is understood. But like you say, there's not too much pushback on that. The other thing that's a best practice is it's not just a sales organizational it's not just a sales organization methodology. So if you were to speak to my CEO, if you were to speak to my COO, we all talk the same language. So in a forecast review with them, like, they're asking as many interesting questions about, like, what Medic gaps do we have, or help me understand the personality of this champion, as I am, right? So the consistency of that language across the executive suite, the client services, I think is very important. And then lastly, if you, to your point, if you only use it as a somewhat static qualification tool, kind of a yes or no, I think you're very limited. Mm-hmm. But it requires more training, and it requires process to really get it to tell you what you need to do and what's missing and how you proactively change the facts that you have. To me, that's the most important element of it.
Yeah, I love that. I love the way you explain that. I think that well, you mentioned command of the message there as well from force management. And I'd love to know, if you were sort of, you mentioned those that sort of trifecta of pipeline generation, the sort of value selling methodology and MedPick. Do you feel, this is a question I really like to ask, is do you feel that if you imagine that as your playbook or your sales motion, do you feel that you, when you go to a new organization and you're brought in as CRO, do you feel that your playbook stays mostly the same, regardless of the organization you're working for? Is there a percentage that you think changes? I guess how much of it's the same? It's fascinating to me.
Yeah. For me, it is largely, I think it stays the same if the type of sale stays the same. Mm-hmm. So for, if you're in more of a transactional sale or less, I've tended to enjoy and stay in organizations where it's more large transformational software sales. It's very complex selling. So I think the motion and those things are largely the same. If it's a little less so than the emphasis on, having a full value framework and those things might be a little less, I think it's still important. But by and large, I've found that these fundamentals, these pillars, haven't changed that much. Their application, the emphasis, can vary a little bit.
That's interesting. I have a theory for, I agree, by the way, and I have a theory for why that is, which is that if you look back to the nucleus of how Medic was created, which was looking at why PTC were winning deals and losing deals and what were the elements of that, it's basically you're answering the question of why have people either bought or not bought. And therefore, what Medic does is sit very nicely over the top of as a buying process, not necessarily a selling process. And I think that if you look through time, even though it's been 20, 25 years, almost 30 years now, people still buy the same way. Of course, we've had technology change from perpetual software licenses to SaaS, and the business models have changed. But actually, underneath it all, and there may be more consensus and more people involved and all that sort of stuff. But I think that is actually less about how people buy. I think that's more about the stakeholders that are involved. So what I mean by that is when you're selling PTC, and I don't mean to, I don't know it anywhere near as well as you do, but you were selling a solution that went in, boom, like that, and the engineers used it. If you're selling something like your last sort of three or four technologies, it goes here, but it has to connect here and has to connect here, and it needs to be in the cloud. And because it's in the cloud, it has to have this security and this infrastructure and all of a sudden, it's a much, much wider sell with many, many more stakeholders. And therefore, it becomes a more of a consensus sell just by the nature of it. So it's interesting to me to hear you say that, that your playbook stays the same. And I just think that's because your playbook matches more, less so what you're selling, more so who you're selling to.
Yeah, that's very true. I mean, back to the Medic, I describe the way when people ask me what Medic is, I describe it as sales physics.
Okay.
It's immutable. It doesn't change over time, right? It tells you the characteristics of what's happening in your opportunity. You have to have the courage to be honest with yourself about those characteristics, but it doesn't change. To your point, though, I do think that some types of buying have changed. Certainly consensus buying and some of these large, transformational initiatives that might have, you know, your economic buyer might be three or four people.
Right.
Which is very challenging. So, you know, what that pushed me to do is really advance my thinking specifically around champions and champion building, which is where, and probably, you know, the challenger customer is what is got me thinking along those lines, right? So, you know, their research shows that 5.6, you know, key stakeholders are involved in each one of these enterprise decisions. And what we were struggling a little bit with was, you know, finding this unicorn of one person. And yes, you want multiple champions, but like one entity that possessed all these characteristics that we needed. And furthermore, so many different types of personalities. So when you look at the concept of a mobilizer, which really speaks to, you know, their ability to sell for you and like start with this within the organization changes greatly depending on the motivations of that person. So concepts like breaking a champion down into like, what kind of champion are they? What kind of mobilizer are they? Are they a teacher? Are they a go-getter? Allows you to better speak to their personal wins. Might not always be a promotion. If you're a teacher, these people get their recognition through like accomplishments that they've done and their ability to like grow an organization. So I think it really, you have to continually mature these approaches based on your sale and based on the way people are buying today.
That is fascinating. I think that's the first time I've seen someone so eloquently overlay challenger over the top of Medic, particularly the champion. You mentioned a moment earlier when you were talking about how you engage with other C-level people in your organization and you know, in a forecast environment, and you were talking about the personality of the champion. Is that what you're referring to? So your CEO would be, you sort of, the language, as you put it earlier, is so sort of well-defined that your CEO is asking you what kind of personality of champion that you have in a deal.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, I think, and not only the Medic language, but then obviously the value-based selling language all being consistent, right? So I think that helps us move faster. It helps us to have more consistency and how we think about the opportunities, and it gets everyone in the organization like selling and like helping move these opportunities forward.
Yeah, I love that. Do you have, with that in mind then, where I like this sort of the idea of the mobilizer being, you know, these different personas, if you like, do you have, when you're working with your sales team, the same way as most people will use Medic, will look for a champion and they'll look for the criteria. Are you saying you go a layer down and then you start to identify? And if you do, you know, the different types of mobilizer, and if you do, do you capture that somewhere? How do you manage that?
Yeah. So I would say specifically on the champion aspect, you know, at a one-on-one level, of course, you're talking about like, what does that mean? Like, what, you know, will they sell for you? Do they have a personal win? Do they have power and influence? Like some of those key rules. At a 201 level, you're teaching, okay, how do we develop these? What are the characteristics? How do we test them, right? It's this 301 level where we start to understand, okay, their personal wins might be very different kind of based on their personalities. And this is where the challenger types and the mobilizer types in challenger customer really helped me see a more refined way to look at that. And then, you know, certainly then applying that in how you mirror those clients, customers, how you develop those champions, how you build the relationships. It also helps because, you know, in a situation where you might need to have three or four different contacts, you know, we can you know, my CEO might be responsible for developing a relationship with this person. I'm responsible for this person. It's a multi-stakeholder and a multi-champion development sort of exercise.
Sure. I guess for the folks that are listening, watching, that haven't read the Challenger Customer book, and you refer to the mobilizer there. What is it you would say that differentiates a mobilizer over a standard champion? I know there's sort of three different types, but what is there like a key thing that straight away, as soon as you see it or hear it, you think, oh, that could be a potential mobilizer?
Yeah, I mean the main difference is that the mobilizer types they talk about in the Challenger sale are the kind that have because you can pretty easily take the types and divide them into okay, these are coaches and these are more applicable for a champion. So they all possess the characteristics of having power and influence based on what they've done. They can all sell and they all have personal wins, but they're just different gradients of that and different ways of thinking about it. And, you know, as you can imagine, if one type of mobilizer is a go-getter, which is what you might expect, right? It is someone that is interested in that promotion, is interested in like growing the organization, which is very different from a teacher that maybe is happy where they are. That's not really what matters to them. So I think it really helps you when you're developing those personal wins and the relationship with them.
Sure. I think one of the things when I was reading the book that stood out for me was how, and it was kind of a, you know, sometimes the best, most thought-provoking methodologies or frameworks, whatever they are, the ones that don't quite, they almost don't quite fit in your mind of what you're expecting. And I think the idea of the mobilizer being almost sort of not necessarily a champion of you, your company, but more so, and a good way I found to understand it was more so a champion of the idea or the concept or the value that you're delivering. So they don't care. They don't care if it's, you know, yours has got blue whistle, you know, blue buttons or green buttons or what you call it, what your category is called. They really care about themselves and their organization, which I know is something we talk about a lot in value-based selling, all that sort of stuff. But when you think about the champion, people very rarely, I find, relate the champion to the business. They always think of the champion as the one that likes your logo, that likes you, rather than what it is that you represent and the specific value you find.
Yeah, which can be dangerous, right? Because if your champion is not doing the things that are in the best interest absolutely for the company, like that's a problem. Mm-hmm. And can cause you challenges. So to me, what has to come first is like demonstrating the value to that champion that you can affect the organization in a way that helps them. If you achieve that first, then what follows is the, you know, why you or why your organization. Right. So I think you're right. The converse is also true. I mean, how many of our sellers have been tricked by, that they're a champion, but they're just a champion for doing something for the organization, not necessarily us yet. They haven't attached to us. So it is a critical thread you have to maintain.
Yeah, and I see a real challenge in competitive sectors of technology there, where you find your mobilizer champion, you get them excited about the possibility of what you can bring as a solution, and because of their nature of being agnostic and only not necessarily attaching themselves to you but to the value, then your competitor just comes and goes, oh yeah, we do that as well. We've got one of those, we can do that. And
right. And then you're in the one of three problem when you're like, now it's all about price.
Yeah.
This is why the value-based selling is so important in terms of that triad, because if your team is not expert mm-hmm. in not only diagnosing the problems and the pains, but within the decision criteria, clearly setting the required capabilities to favor, and you're not doing it in a way to trick them. Like it has to be real, But if you've not set your required capabilities such that, I mean, what we talk about is like, we don't want a fair fight, right? We want to set these required capabilities such that we have an unfair advantage against the competition. And therefore, the champion, it isn't like they're all the same. We're going to pick the one with the best price or the one we like. It's because it's really the only one that can accomplish what they're trying to do.
Right. And when you're talking about required capabilities, you're referring to command of the message and that element of things, which I always think works very nicely with the decision process. Would you say that they sit nicely together?
Yeah, certainly the decision process in terms of the way that those things are assessed, but specifically the decision criteria, very analogous to the required capabilities in terms of whether those, you know, holistic required capabilities that sort of match up to more sort of the financial aspects of decision criteria or the technical decision criteria around like very specific, you know, you're here today and you're in this pain, you're trying to get to this future state. What are you missing? Like, what are the specific things you're missing? And then once you get the client to like buy in and agree on that, it's a matter of explaining and selling how you're uniquely qualified to meet those criteria.
I really like that. I do really like that. One of the challenges I've seen over time is this idea that when you identify the required capabilities and you know you try and kind of make them stick, as you were sort of saying there, so that they become differentiators, but not necessarily in the customer's eyes, but they become the criteria that the customer thinks is the technical criteria they need to buy in this case. But one thing that I often see sellers having trouble with is how to articulate those back to the customer. They may have an understanding, an agreement, and you can verbally discuss that. But is there any good tips or good ways you, with your sales teams, get those required capabilities to kind of be almost agreed in writing is what an ideal state would be.
Yeah, it's interesting. The I'm a firm believer that in these competitive battles, it's all about like who owns, who ends up like defining the decision criteria. Right. And what discovery and the solidification of those happens throughout the sales process. I mean, a best practice we employ is every single call we have, we are resetting up front. Like, here's what we understand. Here's the problem. Here are the required capabilities you talked about. Like, let's verify that, right? So we actually have slides that say what we understand, and it's the required capabilities are in writing there, and we're talking about them, because it's not uncommon for a new stakeholder or even the EB who hasn't been involved yet to come in at that point. And you really want to cement those so that come decision time, those things aren't lost.
Right. I love that. And what you're touching on there is something that I really am interested in, and I think it's something certainly in Europe that I think we're a bit shy about. And I don't know whether it's the same in the US, but this idea that for me, Medic and actually command of the message in this case, value selling, if the customers knew what we were doing, they thought, oh, you've asked that question because you're trying to uncover some more pain or some more metrics, or you're trying to figure out who the economic buyer is. Or if a real interested customer knew what we were doing, they would buy into it. They would not be disappointed. They wouldn't feel like they were trying to be sort of sold to in any other way than is honest and to give them the best possible experience.
100%. What I tell my team is that the way we sell is as value adding and differentiating to that customer as the product.
Right.
We're the doctors. We're the one helping uncover and find the problem and help them prescribe a solution. Right. We see this every day. Like, these clients, they may have never tackled these problems before. So it's a very, again, when you do it right and you do it in a way that's genuine. Mm-hmm. And if you are truly helping the customer, there's no other way to sell.
Yeah. But, and here's my but of what I was sort of saying, we in Europe, we almost shy of that. It's almost like we don't, where you're saying you put up on a slide the required capabilities. I love that. And I think,
I think you should call it the required capabilities. I think we should call out, this is the technical criteria. This is the criteria you're making the decision on. Have I got this right? You know, the worst that can happen there for me
is that the customer says, well, no, actually you've missed something, or no, we're not, that's not important to us as that is.
That's the best thing, but that's a good thing. But yeah.
But you just see what I mean. That's the point. Yeah. That is the worst thing that can happen, is you can find out you're wrong. So it's actually, you're right. It's kind of the best thing, because you don't want to, I guess you in an ideal situation, you are just right, but you don't want the customer, if you're wrong, to not tell you you're wrong. So yeah, I see what you mean.
I get that it's uncomfortable. This way, you have to get a little bit comfortable with being uncomfortable in this mode, but you have the conviction that you're honestly doing what's best for them, and you're doing what's best for your champion in getting to the heart of exactly what they need to accomplish what they're trying to do.
Yeah. And you're touching on something here that really fascinates me. And I'm pleased we can talk about it, because I'm really keen to hear your perspective on it. And that is that in sales, we so often talk about EQ, emotional intelligence. And the best definition I've ever heard, and I wish I could remember who I'd heard say it so I could credit to them, but the best definition I've heard of emotional intelligence is, if you have high EQ, then you'll be very well aware of the reactions that your actions have on other people's emotions. So it doesn't necessarily mean that if you have high EQ, then you make everyone else feel happy emotions. It just means you're aware of how your emotions have an impact. I think that's a really important distinguishing. I don't know if that's a word, but that's an important way of distinguishing it, because in selling, I think that we feel so often that we have to constantly make our prospective customers feel good, you know. And for me, there's a couple of instances where we have to completely forget about that and almost do the complete opposite. And one of them is in discovery, when we're trying to surface some pain and implicate the customer in that pain. So they you know, to get proper pain to the surface, you have to make the customer uncomfortable. So that's an instance there. And like you said, you know, sometimes when we're presenting the value sell and how we do that and some of the commitments we have to get and the questions we have to ask, it is uncomfortable as well. And for me, it's a real interesting challenge that sellers will have, because, you know, as I say, a good seller will have high EQ, so therefore they'll be hyper conscious that they'll be making the customer uncomfortable. And it's almost like understanding how far you can push and how negative in this instance you can get. It's almost like a balancing act, isn't it? You go too far and the uncomfortableness isn't worth the pain you uncover.
Right. And, you know, the uncomfortableness might have to do with how deep you need to dig into the pain of the situation, and having the awareness to know, okay, this is a full room and, you know, they're expecting a presentation, how far you can go in these circumstances. It is a little bit tricky. But I find, the best sellers are able to push it a little bit and find that kind of bleeding edge where ultimately the benefits are that you're helping the organization really see the severity of the problem.
Yeah. And I think that comes back to what you were saying around the challenger customer, where the age old, you know, tell me what's keeping you awake at night, which, you know, if you were to tell to like a mobilizer type customer, they'll sort of roll their eyes. Whereas what we're actually looking to do is to tell the customer what's keeping them awake at night. And I think that though it's sort of almost like a cliche sort of saying thing, I think that really for me is the difference between modern discovery and, you know, the old the discovery that doesn't work. And I had an instance with a relatively new seller who came to me and said, look, you know, that I thought it was the customer was super well qualified. You know, they really should love what we do, but after the first meeting, we didn't get a first meeting, and I can't understand it. Mm-hmm. And so today we have the luxury of watching back the calls, because it's, you know, it's all recorded on Zoom, right, via, you know, Gong or Chorus or any of those techs. So I could watch it back. And what I could instantly see was that it wasn't discovery in that, you know, let's make this two-sided, so that as much as I understand what your problems and challenges and goals are, you also bring those to the surface and they become very relevant to the conversation. Right.
It wasn't. It was just a. It was just a. An interrogation almost.
Right. Right. And you know, use the word two-sided, but it, you know, basically questions and discovery that add value in both directions. Yes. Right. So, I find, lazy discovery to be like, that's what happens.
Yes.
And yeah, don't ask me what keeps me up at night, right? Show me you've done your homework as a seller to know what's, you know, what kind of challenges my organization has. And ask me some thought-provoking questions that lead me to believe you might actually be able to help me.
Right. And I think that's where you can bring metrics to the table in early in opportunities, I think. And I think one of the things I've seen happen a lot is people think about metrics as something that you have to, it's almost they come in on a slope and you have to sort of get a certain part into the opportunity before you can introduce metrics, because at the start, except for looking in the annual report and the outside in, you're unlikely to have an idea of metrics. Yeah. But actually, I almost see it as like two different slopes. And it's the first slope is where you bring in the evidence you've had from your other customers and other, you know, in similar industries. And you start with those and you start up here and it falls off, because at some point the actual metrics specific to that customer can come in. And I think that is a for people that are new to Medic and new to, you know, value-based selling, leading with metrics that you think will be relevant from past experience, right, and success you've had can be the kind of the way of keeping it on track for a good value-based conversation.
100%. I think the way you described it is very similar to how I think about it. Metrics in particular, I think how you use them and how they're defined is dynamic over the course of the sales cycle. To your point, up front, it's all about like, what are the proof points that you have? Like, what are the benchmarks that you can discuss, right? Then it might be, right, what is a preliminary like order of magnitude impact we think we can have on this organization, all the way down to the very end where, you know, who knows, maybe the CFO is the economic buyer and it's a very hard like ROI sort of analysis. So I do think it's very dynamic.
Yeah, that's interesting. One of the things I hear more and more these days, you mentioned the economic buyer, is that the economic buyer is becoming more of a group of people than an individual.
Yeah.
And I do think there is probably more people that meet the criteria of the economic buyer, if you were to break down the things that they have. But I'm not sure whether I'm fully convinced yet that there's still not one overall economic buyer that we really should still be focusing on. And I, you know, maybe there's others that we should focus on too, but I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think certainly, again, back to the type of solutions where you might have three or four different organizations within the company all putting their money together to accomplish something, right? So, you know, if you're selling something, it's a departmental solution, you know, it's a little easier to diagnose. I think you're right in that. I think you were implying, you know, ultimately there probably is an economic buyer that may sit over those. Now, the trick is, do you really have a realistic shot of, you know, how easy is it or how realistic is it to both engage and like directly interact with that person can become very challenging.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a funny one, isn't it? We had a deal, I think earlier this year, actually, where it was a genuine situation where it was a TV network, and the technology we were selling solved a problem for three departments. So it was the product team, the marketing team, and the kind of the performance marketing team, I suppose you'd right, separate them out as. And they genuinely agreed to split the budget 33% each. And we didn't win that deal. Now, it'll be very easy to say that we didn't lose the deal to a competitor either. It was very much a budget challenge because of, you know, COVID and all that sort of stuff. But on reflection, why I bring this deal up is that I think if you took COVID out of the equation, there was still one economic buyer, even though there was sort of three in this case, according to the definition of you know, senior people at the heads of those different departments, but there was one economic buyer, and I almost see it because in any one isolation deal just to one of those departments, the economic buyer of that department would have been by far, you know, qualified enough as an economic buyer. But it's almost because there was those three, it was almost like we needed to go up a level where we wouldn't be before. And it wasn't necessarily because of the deal size, because it wasn't a particularly large deal. But it was just interesting to sort of, and you used a word earlier, which was dynamic. And I think that's you're talking about dynamic metrics, but I think this is where the economic buyer is almost dynamic to the circumstances as well.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, when we review opportunities like this, I always challenge the team to, like, when we think we've diagnosed who the EB or collection of EBs are, like, okay, great. Like, who cares about it above them, right? Like keep don't stop understanding the organization and the dynamics. Because to your point, you know, maybe you could have gotten that deal done under different circumstances, treating those three as EBs. But in this circumstance, maybe the only way to get that deal done was to appeal to someone that owned a much higher level objective.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. And it's, you know, the beautiful thing about sales is you're always learning. That could have been a learning that I never got, but it's so interesting. And it kind of comes back to what you said right at the start, which is around being in the military and, you know, you're constantly training. I think I loved what you said there. And I think that's kind of the beauty of what we do. You know, there's something I learned just a couple of weeks ago that it was almost like a head and hands moment. It's like, why have I not been aware of this sooner kind of thing? And
yeah,
the beautiful thing about this industry, you know, I think.
I think the thing is you can never settle in, and you always have to challenge your thinking. You always have to push yourself on changing your approach. That just makes you better.
Yeah. So we've got time for one more question, and
sure.
I'm excited to ask you this one, which is basically, you've obviously, you know, you've been, as you said, sales leadership 20 odd years now. You've seen a lot. You've got a lot of great experience. What's the one thing that you would tell yourself when you were just getting out started in your sales career, if you had that opportunity to have a time machine or something like that?
Got it. So I'm putting myself in a time machine. I'm going back in time. Like, what's the advice that I would give?
Yeah.
I would say that it is buying into the process. And, you know, we talked a little bit about the uncomfortableness, right? So pushing yourself in a mode where you can feel uncomfortable, right? Because you have a support structure. There's very few selling today where there aren't people to help you, right? So continually pushing yourself, continually trying new things, you know, that's the way you're going to get better.
I love that. That falls so nicely into what I kind of define as the difference between the order taker and the elite seller. And the elite seller is, you know, it's kind of that criteria of doing things for the good of the customer, for the good of the deal, which don't happen to be necessarily what the customer thinks is for the good of them and the good of the deal. They're the very separate things. And I think that kind of trusting in the process, kind of embracing, almost like that. I think there was I'm gonna kick myself forgetting who said this. It might have been a Mike Logan thing. Embracing the suck, I think, was something.
Embrace the suck. That's an old Ranger school adage, but yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Basically, get comfortable with being uncomfortable, right?
That's exactly it. Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, like, you know, I talked about those three sales pillars. You know, PG, value selling, and medic. You know, what surrounds those are some core, like, characteristics that you really need to develop as a seller: discipline, expertise, you know, the ability to work in process, and then that last one of courage, right? The ability to really push yourself and bring those together.
I love it. Cliff, this has been phenomenal. Thank you so much for giving up a good hour of your time today to talk to me.
Enjoyed doing it and enjoyed speaking with you.
Been awesome. Thank you so much. And I can't wait to get this one out, because I think this is going to be a really, really good episode.
Outstanding. Well, thank you so much. And we'll talk soon.
Hey, so that wraps up episode number 2 of Masters of Medic. Thank you so much for listening, and if you liked what you heard, then please leave a rating and don't forget to subscribe.